This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The threat of severe flooding rolls down the mighty Mississippi.
And now the ripple effects are spreading far away from the banks of the river.
From APM, American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Wednesday, May 11th.
Coming up, we'll explore the connection between floodwaters and gas prices.
The CEO of Starbucks says don't blame him for expensive coffee.
And Steve, do you know what the first rule of robbing a bank is?
You know, Jeremy, I haven't robbed a bank lately, so no.
Well, it's BYOB, and we will explain that coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The price of oil is trading at about $103 a barrel today, up $4 from last week. And gasoline futures have been on the rise, too. Oil traders seem to be taking their cues from what the Mississippi River is doing in Louisiana. And Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports from the Sustainability Desk.
The flooding has already wreaked havoc in Tennessee, Arkansas, and Mississippi. Louisiana is next, and that could mean trouble for U.S. oil refineries. Industry consultant Andy Lippow.
Between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, there are 11 refineries.
And they handle 13% of U.S. fuel production. Fears that flooding could curtail or even shut them down is pushing gasoline futures higher. Lippow says high waters may slow down river barges and tankers.
And that may result in a reduction of crude processing, although refinery shutdown is quite unlikely.
That's because levees appear strong enough to hold back the floodwaters. Analyst Bob Vandervolk says he's more worried about hurricane season.
And these hurricanes are anticipated to hit these refineries this year. It'll be an instant replay of Katrina and Rita.
Katrina shut down 10% of U.S. refinery capacity for several months. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Now let's turn to AIG. The company announced this morning that it and the Treasury Department will go ahead with the sale of about $9 billion in shares this month. The government is trying to at least break even on the insurance giant that it bailed out during the financial crisis. And it looks like breaking even is about the best it's going to do after a disappointing quarter for AIG, which lost money in its property insurance business because of the earthquake in Japan. Let's bring in Richard DeKayser. He's an economist with the Parthenon Group, and he's with us now from Boston, as he is each Wednesday. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
So do you think the government is making the right move here in going ahead with this sale of AIG stock right after the stock took such a beating?
I do. It's up substantially today. But here's the deal. The government is holding about $48 billion in AIG, which translates into an effective price of $28 and change. As I said, today it's trading over 31, so it will make a profit. And we need to remember that the reason the government did this in the first place was not to speculate on the stock market, but to prevent a financial Armageddon from playing
right
out. So I think it's time to start paring back, and this is less of a profit than it would have been, but we're still coming out ahead.
Do you think, Richard, that there's ever going to be a point that you and I will be able to talk about Wall Street firms that are totally free of government assistance?
Well, it depends what you mean by assistance. If you mean holding ownership positions, yes, I'd say we're a few years away from that. But the government's always going to be providing assistance in other ways, if only indirectly. I mean, deposit insurance at banks is a form of government insurance, which is provided in a monopoly format without a profit. So that sort of thing is going to be going on for a long time after the remnants of the financial crisis have long since passed.
Richard DeKayser, economist with the Parthenon Group. Thanks as always.
My pleasure.
All right, off to Illinois now, Richard and Jeremy, which is increasing its tax on businesses to deal with a huge budget deficit. Some big name companies are threatening to leave the land of Lincoln. And from Chicago Public Radio, Susie Ahn reports.
You know that great Chicago icon, the Sears Tower? Well, that's no more. It's called the Willis Tower now because Sears moved its headquarters to a cheaper location in the suburbs. And with rising taxes, Sears is considering yet another move to another state. Paul Swinand analyzes Sears for Morningstar.
I think overall, Sears is purely looking at the bottom line. So the company has been struggling recently, and if they can get significant tax savings, they can take that money and plow it back into the business.
Illinois Governor Pat Quinn says he is willing to negotiate tax incentives.
We will sit down with the Sears people and their representatives and elected representatives. I'm sure we'll work out something.
Quinn seems to be coming to the table a lot lately. Recently, Illinois made a deal with Motorola Mobility. That company is getting a $100 million tax break over the next 10 years. In Chicago, I'm Susie Ahn for Marketplace.
Well, Steve, have you had your cup of office coffee this morning?
I've had a couple of cups, thank you.
Well, very good. Well, here in New York, I actually have to go out and buy the coffee
for
real money. And it's a bit more expensive than usual. And for a lot of people, they're noticing it's a bit more expensive than usual these days. But Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz says, don't blame him. He says speculators are causing coffee prices to soar. He's in the UK, and he said market manipulation is what's driven the price of coffee beans to a 34-year high. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Last month, coffee cost an average of $2.31 a pound. That's almost double what it was a year ago. This is not due to supply and demand, claims Howard Schultz. The Starbucks chief told the BBC that speculators have been covertly pushing up the price of coffee and other agricultural commodities.
I wish there was a lot more transparency involved in the process in which we could really understand what the index funds, the hedge funds are doing. It's a very strange phenomenon.
Schultz wants the regulators to wake up and smell the coffee and investigate. But Keith Flurry, commodities analyst at Rabobank, says there's little mystery about the high coffee price. Supply is being outstripped by demand, especially in emerging markets.
There's a lot more competition for the beans internationally, not just from cafe drinkers in Europe, but cafe drinkers in China, as well as drinkers in Brazil themselves.
Helping to drive that demand, he says, is the huge growth in the number of cafes, like Starbucks, opening up around the world. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The U.S. bought more goods than it sold in March, widening the nation's trade deficit to the highest level since June of last year.
And the Mortgage Bankers Association says mortgage applications jumped last week at the fastest pace in 2 months. Interest rates dropped for a fourth straight week.
More numbers anytime at the numbers section of our website, marketplace.org.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Now let's get to the Marketplace global perspective, and we'll start in Japan with the figure 77%. That's how much Toyota's profits dropped in the latest quarter after the earthquake and tsunami in Japan disrupted the automaker's supply chain. Let's get the details from David Gura. He joins us now from the Marketplace Washington Bureau. Good morning, David.
Morning, Jeremy.
So profits at Toyota were the lowest in 6 quarters. How much of that can be attributed to the natural disasters in Japan?
Well, they had a huge effect. I talked to Ashvin Chotai, the managing director of Intelligence Automotive Asia, and he told me the carmaker had been doing a lot better, recovering from the economic slump back in 2008 and 2009, but their operations really took a hit. And Chotai said Toyota has had and continues to have problems getting the parts it needs to build its cars.
As we know, the global supply chain is quite interrelated, and what the tsunami has exposed is how dependent it is on very often one or two key suppliers, which in this case happened to be in the earthquake zone.
Another problem Chotai told me is that in the aftermath of the disasters, the Japanese government has decided to test its nuclear plants, not just the ones affected by the earthquake and the tsunami. So, Jeremy, there are power shortages and power outages across the country.
And, David, even before the disasters in Japan, there was this gas pedal issue and all those recalls at Toyota. Are those having any effect?
You know, that issue really hasn't gone away. Around 10 million cars were recalled. Ashvin Chotai told me that Toyota had made progress restoring its image. Another problem is the strength of the yen. That makes Japanese products more expensive to consumers abroad. But, Jeremy, it's really about the production problems as a result of the quake, and now Toyota may end up falling behind its rivals GM and Volkswagen.
Marketplace's David Gura, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, from Japan and Washington to Athens, Greece now, where there are more protests and strikes on the streets there of central Athens, demonstrators are very upset over the possibility the country will privatize many national interests. Well, it's been a year since Greece took a $150 billion bailout from its European neighbors. But even today, the country faces a grim economy. Joanna Kakissis is with us now from Athens, where the protests are taking place. Good morning, Joanna.
Good morning, Steve.
Why is Greece still struggling? I mean, we're talking a year after the bailout, right?
Yeah, well, the country was more than $400 billion in debt, and it had a lot of work to do. The government drastically cut spending and public sector wages and pensions and even raised taxes. It made good progress, cutting the deficit by 5%, but the cuts stalled the economy. Unemployment is at a high of 15%, and Greeks are anxious.
They're anxious. What would privatizing state-owned businesses do, Joe?
Well, it would raise a lot of cash, about $72 billion by 2015. The government wants to sell its stakes in three utilities, plus the Greek railway, the racetrack, and the national lottery. It also wants to lease or sell unused facilities from the 2004 Olympics and the old airport. But unions are fighting it. They say the privatization would kill jobs. A few thousand demonstrators are expected today, and their aim is to put pressure on the government ahead of an expected vote next week on the asset sale.
Do most Greeks feel the same way as the demonstrators in the streets now?
Well, actually, no, they don't. Most are actually very worried about the economy collapsing, and so they want to see the austerity measures bearing fruit.
All right, Joanna Kakissis reporting from Athens. Joanna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
The United States has given Pakistan roughly $18 billion in aid since 2002. Most of it's been spent on helping the Pakistanis with counterterrorism and development. But since Osama bin Laden's death, American lawmakers have been questioning whether the financial assistance should continue. The BBC's Leslie Kerwin reports.
The chill in political relations between the U.S. and Pakistan is worrying the Pakistani business community, even though U.S. financial aid contributes very little to Pakistan's GDP. Kamran Misra is the chief executive of the Pakistan Business Council. He says right now the impact for businesses is mostly psychological.
You know, U.S. is the world's only superpower. We've always had good relations with them. There's a lot of history to it. There is a general discomfort about the strained relation, and businesses also feeling that strain.
Misra says there was a similar situation after 9/11, but that eventually the economy rebounded. For many Western companies, though, doing business in Pakistan is still high risk because of the security threat. But Misra says these problems are minor compared to infrastructure issues, especially insufficient power. He says U.S. aid would be better spent on developing the Pakistani economy by investing in the private sector, rather than giving money directly to the government. In London, I'm the BBC's Leslie Kerwin for Marketplace.
Well, the long-anticipated bullet train that will connect China's two most important cities had its first trial run today. The Shanghai to Beijing high-speed train is the latest addition to what is now the most extensive high-speed rail network in the world. But as Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, there have been some bumps along the way.
In just 8 years, China's become the bullet train capital of the world. President Obama's pointed to it as a model for high-speed rail. But lately, its squeaky clean image has been tarnished. China admitted the man in charge of its railway ministry was allegedly involved in embezzling millions from the Beijing-Shanghai project. John Scales is a transportation specialist at the World Bank in Beijing.
All indications from the government and also from our own dealings with the Ministry of Railways is that the Chinese government has confirmed that the mid- and long-term development plan is still valid.
That plan is to have 8,000 miles of high-speed rail by the end of the year and twice that by 2020. The train between Beijing and Shanghai will take less than 5 hours to cover a distance that's more or less equal to the distance between New York City and Chicago. It'll start running in June. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Well, to Okeechobee County, Florida now, Steve, where a would-be bank robber forgot a very important piece of equipment. Handed a note to the teller last Friday and demanded a bag full of cash.
Yeah.
Only problem was, the teller didn't have a bag and neither did the robber. He forgot the BYOB rule of bank robbery.
Yeah, bring your own bag. That's right.
So he left the bank and 7 minutes later he was bagged by police.
Alabama's Governor Robert Bentley now says insured losses from the deadly tornadoes last month will top $2 billion. And those losses include all the homes damaged or destroyed by the storms, people who were rendered temporarily homeless, and perhaps in a twist of reality, some say the need for housing could actually help Alabama's slumping housing market. Larry Coward is a real estate expert and professor of accounting and finance at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, UAB, and he's with us now to talk about it. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Doing well. We're obviously not trying to find any kind of bright side to the devastation in Alabama. I saw it certainly firsthand in Tuscaloosa. But people are going to need housing, right?
There's over 5,000 houses destroyed in two counties, plus there's another 1,000 distributed over a much wider area. Here in Birmingham, there's sufficient supply to take care of all the people who were displaced.
What does this mean for the housing situation in Alabama?
Well, in Birmingham, there's about 10 to 12,000 houses on the market for sale right now. And at the current rate of sale, based on last month's sales, it would take 12 months for every one of those houses to be sold. Of course, now we're going to get to the bottom of the market a lot quicker than in other places. So for us, this will kind of start the absorption to get us back to a normal market.
Thousands of people, as you said, lost everything in those storms. Where's the money going to come from, Larry, to buy up these properties all over the state?
In the short run, there's going to be an inflow of cash to cover the insurance cost for those people who had insurance. The federal government, the state government, there's a lot of donations that are bringing things into the Birmingham area to try to help everybody out. The cost of this is going to be significant. The estimates right now are, you know, $2 to $5 billion, and going up every day. The long-term damage is going to be pretty significant.
Well, our thoughts, of course, are with the folks in Alabama and all throughout the South as they try and recover from these horrible storms. Larry Cowart, professor of real estate and finance at UAB, thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. Nice talking to you.
Retailers are starting to clear space on their shelves. That's to make more room for tablet computers, which are expected to outsell laptops by next year. Tablets like the iPad are also being called the killer of the e-reader. It seems most consumers just want everything in one place and on one device. Let's talk about that now with LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Well, it sounds like everybody wants everything on one device, and companies are more than happy to make that happen.
Of course. And, you know, who wouldn't want it? Because there's a convenience factor involved here. And what this is going to mean is a number of consumer products are going to disappear, if not altogether, then gradually. And, you know, I work for a newspaper. I know all about digital technology upending existing standards. So I think we should prepare for things to disappear, if not in the near future, then coming up soon.
Well, what kinds of things do you think will be going away?
Well, look at wristwatches, for example. Young people simply don't wear them. Why? Because people just, you know, they carry around their smartphone. It gives them the time. So wristwatches will have some nostalgia value, but I don't think they're going to have a lot of staying power. CDs, DVDs, those are gimmies. They're out of here completely.
Yeah.
GPS devices? You're not going to need a separate one of those, not when you've got a smartphone around. And here's an interesting one, address books. You'll keep all of that stored on your whatever mobile service. I knew that that was the shape of things to come when I did that myself. And I'm the last guy to always do that kind of thing.
You got everything on your phone. Is there anything that consumers might want to keep separate?
Well, people talk about how books are facing their demise from e-readers. I just don't see that happening anytime soon. I think books will have some staying power. They're just too portable, too convenient. And here's another interesting one. Game consoles like PlayStations and Xboxes and Wiis, they take so much computing power to run the state-of-the-art games right now. I just don't know if you can pack that much power into a lightweight device like an iPad or an iPod and still have the same playability. So my suspicion is we're going to see game consoles around for a bit longer.
And David, are there any things consumers should be worried about when it comes to putting everything in one place?
Yeah, losing the darn thing. You lose your device and you've lost half your life now. So if there's any one thing I want to leave people with, it's back up your data. Back it up.
LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And finally, Jeremy, the cardigan sweater. You remember the cardigan sweater that was worn by Jeff Bridges in the movie The Big Lebowski?
Oh,
the
yeah.
The dude.
The dude. His dudeness.
The dude. His dudeness. That's right. The brown and orange and beige sweater. It's a zip-up knit sweater.
Yep.
It's up for auction this weekend in Beverly Hills at this Hollywood memorabilia auction. The opening bid should be around $5,000, but you know this cardigan's going to go for a lot more than that.
Oh, yeah.
And you remember, of course, the dude wore that sweater everywhere. There were actually an interesting little tidbit here. The sweater was made actually at this clothing manufacturer in Oregon, but they made four of them. Only one of them was the one that Jeff Bridges would wear. The other three were just copies in case they needed to use them later on down the road. So this is the original.
In case there was a bowling mishap or something
like that. In case there was
a
bowling mishap, exactly, or something like that. But you know what's not up for bid at this auction this weekend, Jeremy? The rug that really tied the room together.
Oh,
not up for bid.
That, you can't buy that anywhere. No price is high enough for the rug. It really ties rooms together.
It does.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.